Hey, everybody. Welcome back to So You Want to Be in Ministry. I'm Tim, and we are all about honoring faithfulness in ministry. And we get to talk to another really incredible guest today. I'm so thankful for all of these individuals that are willing to come on and just share what God has done with them and how he's brought them through different aspects of ministry. And today is no different. We have Matt Lapine on the podcast today. He's from Duluth, Minnesota. He is the Director of Discipleship and Equipping at City Light Church in Omaha, Nebraska. He has served as an adjunct professor at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Reformed Theological Seminary, teaching Old and New Testament theology, hermeneutics, ethics, apologetics, and theological foundations of counseling. He holds a PhD from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Illinois under Kevin Van Hooser. His dissertation was published, and it's The Logic of the Body. I'm going to try to put this up here for you. I have it on my Kindle. So it is a deep read. It is not something that you're just going to pick up, get tons of practical things in a short amount of time. You're going to have to put effort into it. I'm currently putting effort into it. I wish I would have had it done when I had this interview, because it's so full of things, and I'm going to have him back on or something just to go deeper into it. But it was published in 2020 and it was a finalist for Christianity Today's Book of the Year in Theology and Ethics in 2021. He writes on theology and mental health and is working to bridge the gap between church and seminary by teaching theology within the local church. He's also married to Molly. They've lived in Iowa, Texas, Ohio, and Wisconsin, and they have three girls. Matt also, I got to play college basketball with him. This is not surprising that he went down this path to me. He was always a deep thinker. He was always pursuing education and wanted to understand things. And I think the conversation on mental health and the psychology of us is an important topic. And Matt knows way more about it than I do. And I loved this conversation with him. So let's get into this interview with Matt. Well, hey, Matt, glad to have you on the podcast today. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, so glad to be here. It's fun to reconnect after almost 20 years.
I know, 20 years. We got to spend some time getting to know each other. This is another one of my basketball squad mates.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Gold team forever. We always beat the starters.
Yeah, we enjoyed beating the starters in practice, and they hated it. Yeah, that was fun. They're going to listen to this, and they comment. I welcome the comments from that.
They're still running lines from what we did to them.
Oh, it was so much fun. we could use our energy in practice. We knew we didn't have to save it for the game.
That's right. Were you there when Micah ordered a pizza on the bench? Was that?
Oh my word!
Were you on the team?
I don't think if I was, maybe that's when I was actually playing. I don't know. But, I don't remember him doing that, but that sounds like Micah for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely, man. Well, hey, so you got a lot of history. You're an author. You got a book. I think you might be, maybe. You might be my first doctorate. No, you're not my first doctorate, but you got your doctorate. So looking forward to talking about some of those things. But let's just start kind of at the beginning of just how did you get, bullet point version, how did you get to where you're at today?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, well, I'm from Duluth, Minnesota, proud Minnesotan, and, yep. Real Minnesota is the cities in north, just in case anybody's wondering. But I grew up in a pastor's home. That was kind of difficult at times because, I actually did have a lot of doubts about my faith. I kind of 10th grade year was kind of wondered if God existed at all. And through junior, senior year, I really was, again, just impressed by the gospel and that this is who I am and this is what I believe. And so I kind of saw it as a stark choice between I serve God or I serve myself. And if I'm going to serve God, then I got to go to Bible college, which is where we met.
Yeah.
At Faith Baptist Bible College and Theological Seminary in Ankeny, Iowa.
I'm trying to
switch to Dr. Haug voice there.
You did great. Yeah. President Haug he'd be proud.
Yeah. So we went to college, didn't have a life plan. I think that's if there's a, funeral epitaph that Molly puts on my headstone, it's going to be didn't have a life plan. but yeah, so I, was youth pastor major, because I was like, my youth pastor was cool. I think I could maybe do that for someone else. And junior year, I took Greek, and I did it because Paul Nemers did it. And I thought, if Paul Nemers can do it, I can do it.
that actually, yeah. actually, that makes sense. I know you all don't know him, but that makes sense.
But I was really glad I did, because that opened a hallway that I didn't know existed. And so after I took Greek, I was like, well, I got to take Hebrew, so I'm going to go to seminary. My wife was teaching full time. And so again, this is just the story of no life plan, but ended up staying 8 years at Faith Baptist Bible College and Theological Seminary, got BA, MA, MDiv. When I walked out of there, it was, in a lot of ways, it was a great place. So there's a lot of people that I love and respect. It also was a bit of a hard experience. So I was conscientiously kind of leaving that group when I walked away. And so not only do I not have a plan, but I also don't have a network. And so what I ended up doing was went down to Dallas Theological Seminary. That's the shortest jump from where we were to another sort of evangelical seminary, and did an STM down there. So we were down there 2 years. My degree is systematic theology. I basically studied philosophy down there with a guy named Doug Blunt. Took, you know, courses that I made up, like one on Immanuel Kant, because honestly, what I was doing was I was still trying to answer questions that I had in 10th grade about, like, is it rational to believe in God? And so in the process, when I was at Faith, I married Molly, who's my wife. We have three girls now. But what we kind of went through some things, and I really had some burning questions about how theology relates to mental health. And so I'm just sort of parking that, because that was back in Iowa. I took an aside and sort of studied, like, is it rational to believe what I believe? But then I was looking for PhD work, because I realized that God had gifted me to think well about the world and about theology. And so I wanted to pursue that degree if you'd open a door. And so I spent 2 years in Ohio. Let me just, because I see in the background here, Tim, that you have the OSU sign. I grew up a Michigan fan. I think we've clashed about that before. But
we all fall short of the glory of God.
I think my one regret was that I moved to Toledo, Ohio, and I lived 2 miles from the Michigan border. I could have just gone north and lived in Michigan. But so one of my kids was
You made a wise choice.
Yeah. But one of my kids was born in Ohio, and we always got like an ornament for our tree to commemorate what happened that year. Yeah. And I actually got a Michigan logo to commemorate her birth, because we were closer to Ann Arbor than any meaningful city in Ohio.
That makes sense.
I'm counting Toledo not as a meaningful city. Sorry if I'm offending anybody, but anyway, so yeah, we spent 2 years teaching high school there, and it was a fantastic sort of dream job, but then God opened a door for me to do PhD work at Trinity. And so, you know, they paid me to go there. And so it was an easy decision. God opened a door for a housing arrangement that really worked out great as well. So I got to study under Kevin Van Hooser, who was probably my theological hero. So I spent 4 great years there, but, I had come in interested in theology and the arts, especially how to read the Bible as literature. So how does the Bible as literature shape us? Mm-hmm. And then realized after a 2-hour argument with a new friend down there that I didn't know what emotion was. And so I was like, I better, you know, tackle that one first, and then we can get to the next one. But that turned into my dissertation, which is published as The Logic of the Body. It's been kind of a wild ride with the dissertation. I was trying to solve problems that I had way back in Iowa, just walking through mental health stuff, with my wife. And, there was some real challenges and tensions with my theology that I kind of worked out there. The book has been received, just beyond my expectations about like how well it's been received. It's been used in seminaries, and it was a finalist for Christianity Today's Book of the year it came out. So it's been really rewarding, primarily just because it has really shaped how people think about emotion, and especially the embodiment of emotion. And so there's a lot of fun conversations happening about emotion, embodiment, trauma, mental health that I've been able to have. So But that's not, you know, nowhere along the way did you hear like, and what I wanted to be when I was done was this. So I remember we were starting to have the conversation, like we've climbed the PhD mountain. We can see the top of it. And then we're like, wait a minute, is there another mountain behind that? Which is like to get an actual job. And so I'm talking about it as if it's funny, but it was actually quite depressing. But
yeah, I mean, I can understand that you kind of achieve it and you're like, now what? It's like almost, it's winning the Super Bowl and going, okay, now what? Yeah.
Disney World, I guess.
Yeah.
Except you can't go to Disney World after a PhD. Nobody pays you to do that.
No.
I ended up basically moving back to my mother-in-law's house for a year. And the point was I had to finish the dissertation actually. So my mentor had a really unfortunate situation, a suicide situation come, and he's like, well, just get it done. Go full-time on the dissertation, part-time work. And so I was working part-time for a church in Ames, Iowa, was able to, then after I defended my dissertation, was able to come on staff full-time, spent 4 years, and really, were a real, really fun 4 years in terms of what I was doing. I was overseeing a partnership with Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And so I kind of have two warring passions. One is theology and mental health, and the other is reconciling a tension that I feel between the church and the seminary. And so it was fun to be able to work on that, like running a program where we were meeting 39 weeks out of the year. Students would come out with 21 credits from Midwestern. It was like a 3-hour meeting every Monday. And so it was a ton of fun to do that. But after 4 years, they decided to end the program. And actually landed this church in Omaha that I'm sitting in that loves taxidermy behind me. Heard that I was available and called and said, hey, would you consider being the director of discipleship equipping and men's ministry here? So that's my current role. I direct discipleship equipping and men's ministry, which involves three core classes. We've been through kind of 2.5 years of developing those and really excited about that. Our men's ministry is thriving culturally. It's just fun to be in the room and see people vulnerable and really digging into study, going through Romans this year. We got, you know, hopes and plans for the future, especially perhaps, training people at a seminary level, but we'll see what doors God opens up.
Yeah. I love your story. I love how you kind of just landed in that. For people that think you can just like plan some bestseller or award-winning thing, like, I mean, you just heard your story where you're just like, oh, I guess this, or I guess, and you, you write it out of self. Like, I just trying to get answers, and people are like, this is the greatest thing. Like,
right.
So in the book, talk a little bit about that book, because people have heard me talk about this on the podcast, but so I tend to read around 50 books a year. I read very quickly. This is going to be one of those books that it's going to take me all year to read. I'm going to have to, I am much more focused on orthopraxy rather than orthodoxy. And this is kind of blending both. And so I think if you're in the when you get into the real practical side, I'll probably fly through it. And when you're dealing with like the depth of everything and the philosophy and stuff, I'm like, I may need to read this one again. So talk a little bit about the book, because it's kind of blending those things.
Yeah. So the book blends history of philosophy, theology, neuroscience, and a little bit of biblical studies stuff. So it's stupid, honestly. The project is because you shouldn't do something that like there's tons of rope that I could have hung myself on. And so if you're wondering why it's difficult and long, it's because I was terrified writing it. But essentially what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give a model for psychology. So one of the things that occurred to me was the psychology that is at the core of a lot of our pastoral recommendations doesn't interface well with clinical mental health counseling. And that tension I felt very poignantly. And what I noticed was a lot of our sort of theological work on psychology was sort of frozen in time because psychology became its own discipline in the late 19th century. And when that happened, theologians stopped talking about psychology, but actually theologians talked about psychology a lot before that. Mm. And so it wasn't so much that, you know, we had no psychological ideas. We had psychological ideas, but they were bad ideas because they weren't integrated with contemporary research on how the psyche works, right? Psychology means the study of the soul. I mean, it's always been part of theology. And so what I did was I actually went back to Thomas Aquinas, because Aquinas has a beautiful and well-developed psychology. And I basically traced how psychology changed between Aquinas and Calvin, who, you know, kind of represents like the headwaters of the Reformed tradition. Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to recommend a Thomistic psychology, and I'll say more why in just a second.
Okay.
But I'm also trying to say this psychology wasn't really around when Calvin was writing, and there's historical reasons for that. So the first 200 pages are basically history. And it gets quite dense, 'cause I'm getting into the minutiae of a lot of things. Yeah. The second half of the book is basically, it's a review of sort of more recent developments in Reformed theology on it. And then like Book of Nature, Book of Scripture, back and forth. So the Book of Nature would be like, what's going on in terms of body and soul? How do we think about that? And so my first contribution is a more holistic account of the soul. Like, soul is not responsible just for our thinking, but for all of our living powers. Okay. And so the problem that people sometimes have is if you're sitting across from somebody and they're telling you about their anxiety, if you're the person disclosing the anxiety, there's a lot of anxiety because you're like, am I going to get compassion or am I going to get correction? Right. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of pastors think, well, anxiety is sin unless it's a bodily issue. And then maybe you should get on meds. Okay. But so it's almost like guilty until proven innocent.
Okay. Yeah.
What you need to realize is that actually anxiety always involves neural pathways. And so there's no like jumping from this is about the soul to this is about the body. They're just intertwined. And if they're intertwined, then suffering and sin are intertwined in a way that you can't disentangle. And so, so that a more holistic account of body and soul, that anxiety is physical as well as spiritual and mental and all those things. What I'm doing after that is I'm basically giving a model. Like, why is it sometimes I, you know that I'm safe, but I feel anxious? Mm-hmm. And it's because actually I have, my thoughts are different than how my body sort of reads the world.
Okay.
And so my choices are different than how I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And there's a relationship between the two. And so I'm just teasing out how that relationship works. And so the outtake of it all is that, is really that we have to be more organic about how we talk about anxiety, but also have to just have a lot more patience and understand how suffering factors in and health factors in. So it's a much more nuanced approach to anxiety that you sometimes get. I mean, I remember reading Future Grace by John Piper and reading that anxiety was sinful unbelief. And that was not helpful at all for my wife at the time. So that's kind of really my target is going after like people who oversimplify anxiety as thoughts and trying to bring embodiment into the picture. So,
yeah, I mean, you go deep. Like if anything that he just said in the overview triggers something, he goes deep in it. Like he's gonna like, and I appreciate that you went extensive, and I appreciate that you didn't just get a project done, but that you did the work and did all. So what is the hang up then going from Aquinas to Calvin? You said there's some reasons for that. What are some of those reasons that got kind of changed the format for Calvin when he enters into the scene?
Yeah. So eventually, I mean, everybody's maybe not everybody, but a lot of people have heard of Rene Descartes. He's a philosopher. He's after Calvin. But Rene Descartes thought that we are essentially thinking things and the body is essentially like a machine.
Okay.
And so the pathway to Rene Descartes actually took a number of different steps. So you're sort of moving historically towards a simpler account of what the soul can do and a more mechanized view of the body. Mm-hmm. And so my point is that Calvin is on the way to Descartes. Okay. So the sort of psychology that Thomas Aquinas had wasn't even possible. Well, maybe it was possible, but it wasn't as common or popular in Calvin's day. So he's adopting a psychology that is nearly there in terms of mechanization of the body. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I think whether we think about it or not, we do that even subconsciously today when we're talking about body mm-hmm. fuel and things like that, where you're viewing right. your body as just a machine that yep. is taking you from place to place. Yeah. I think that's very real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and contemporary neuroscience, really muddies up the picture because, you know, there's a lot more intelligence that's distributed through our body than we acknowledge. So, I mean, gut feelings are famously hard, you know, because you're just like, how trustworthy is my gut feeling? Well, in a lot of cases, they're intelligent, incredibly intelligent. But in a lot of cases, they're also dumb. So one example I give is I walked out of the grocery store once and I looked to the right and panicked. Mm. If you had asked me 20 seconds before, hey, where did you park? I would have said, oh, right in front here, like five rows deep, right? So I knew where I parked. But that was the one day out of almost every time I went to the grocery store, I parked in the first spot on the far right. And when I walked out the door, there was a green van parked in the first spot on the far right. I drove a green van. The driver's door was open. Someone was rummaging around in there. And my body immediately thought, you're being robbed. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. someone's broken into your car. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I didn't, like cognitively, I never would have said that's what's happening. But it's just amazing how intelligent that quick judgment was, even though I knew where I parked. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So there is that tension between what I'm using body in more than one way here, but that sort of lower it's called the logic of the body because we have a sort of unconscious intelligent, which is bound up in our sympathetic nervous system that judges things quickly and reacts to them. So.
So how do you, if you can do this simply, how do you reconcile some of the tension of, I'm going to use air quotes here, quote unquote, bad emotion equals sin. How do you reconcile some of that? Like if there's an easy way to reconcile for people that may be asking that question, just sitting there at home.
Yeah. So one of the last chapters is about Matthew 6, where Jesus says, don't be anxious. Yeah. My observation about how evangelicals typically read that is they read it as a command. So a command is something you can do with words, which makes a directive to someone with a sort of implied threat.
Yeah.
Do this because, you know, there's other types of directives we can give. We can give advice, do this because it's good for you, or do this and I'll help. Like, does that make sense? I mean, but the command with the implied threat is our default mode when it comes to that. There's everything about the passage indicates that actually what he's doing is comforting us, not commanding. Just the use of metaphors, the promise for help, you know, all those things. But the other thing that occurred to me was that we're also assuming that it's a simple command, like raise your arm. Like if I say raise your arm, you can raise your arm, right? There's a difference between saying pass the carrots and grow some carrots, right? So pass the carrots, I can just do it. I pass them. They're within my reach. I have the power, you know. But grow some carrots requires a sustained amount of energy over time and even, you know, good weather and not a tornado and, you know, stuff like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so I think the opposite of don't be anxious in Matthew 6 is seek the kingdom. Why do we assume that we can just stop anxiety in a second by thinking a different thought? What I mean that it's absurd. Pursuing a life free of anxiety is about that sort of deep path of discipleship that grounds ourselves in God's love in a way that changes my identity, but also changes the way that I interface with other people and brings about flourishing and blessing in my life in deep ways, even in the midst of suffering. So. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say, okay, stop saying that someone can just snap their fingers and be done with anxiety, but pay attention to the whole of the means of grace that we have for fighting anxiety.
Yeah. So let me put something out there because this is something I've been walking through. So last November, we were doing a series called King of Hearts, and we were just talking about Jesus as Lord of our life.
Yeah.
And I gave a message that was on idolatry, and I let people know that the idol that I had was anger. And I let them know I wanted to die. Like I'm going to put this thing to death.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been navigating that for about a year. It's been almost exactly a year. I am mm-hmm. a much less angry person today than I was a year ago. But there mm-hmm. was about 3 months in that I was intentionally working very hard on it.
Mm-hmm.
I called one of my friends. You actually know him, Chris Persons.
Mm-hmm.
I called him up and I just said, "Hey man, I am like, I wanted to die. Like it just seems to just come out of me at times, and mm-hmm. I don't want it to." And when it came out of me, I definitely went to a sinful place when I could mm-hmm. in this day that I was calling him. And mm-hmm. he goes, "But I would say that before you were drowning in it, and now you might just be wading in it." And mm-hmm. he goes, "Maybe one day you'll be ankle deep in it, and it'll just be mm-hmm. one of those like garden variety sins that you got to pay attention to, but it's not, you're mm-hmm. not, you're not drowning in it." I was like, "That's true, man. I'm not drowning in it anymore." Would you say that that's kind of a pathway in some of these emotional things? Like you're talking about anxiety.
Yeah.
Like it's a path. It's not like immediate.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think part of it for me is just getting away from the idea that the pathway for spiritual maturity is through thinking alone, you know, it's a matter of walking through life and presenting our bodies as instruments of righteousness, which leads to our sanctification. And I mean, just as an example for me, there's been a lot, these last 3 years have been really hard, and there's been a lot of anxiety and doubt and shame and all these things. So I have this journal where I'm basically saying, what are things that I can't control, and what are things that I can control? Mm-hmm. And then, what are things that I have already, and what are things that I want? And so I'll just make that list every day, you know, and that's a spiritual practice of opening my hands and saying, "Not my will, but thy will be done." And so that kills a lot of anxiety, but it also kills a lot of anger. Does that mean that I'm always free of anger? No, but that's a discipline and a habit that the Spirit uses to renew who I am and remind myself of who I am in God. But it's not like if I get anger, I just, you know, can just remember that thing, and that's the tool. I mean, we have all sorts of tools to use, but it's a process, and part of the reason it's a process is because we are embodied creatures.
Yeah.
So every thought we have runs down a neural pathway. And so there's who we are is sort of wired into us. There's like a who I am in a big sense, like that I'm a human and then I'm Matt and all that. But there's also a quality, like how good a human am I?
Yeah.
do I image God, or is my nervous system arranged in such a way for me to have a hair trigger in anger, you know? But those things, I think, are things that the Spirit is doing in us as he brings our mortal bodies to life. I'm thinking of Romans 8. I think it's verse 17. The Spirit can do that, but it's often a process of habitually submitting ourselves as instruments of righteousness.
Yeah. What do you have any other practical things? So like journaling works for you. Have you come across mm-hmm. other practical things that just help people navigate some of these things over the long haul?
Yeah. I mean, it probably depends on which things. For me, like I've had a habit of, I've also done cognitive behavioral therapy on myself, like cognitive distortions. There's a great book by John Haidt called The Coddling of the American Mind. And okay. he's got a cognitive distortions journal. So okay. I switch back and forth between those two, because I just have to check my lens. Like, okay. am I looking at others, and am I looking at myself and the world in a way that is actually catastrophizing and taking, you know, too much blame? And a lot of that reveals just the ways that I want control and the ways that sin bends me towards myself. But for me, probably the biggest thing has been just practicing healthy relationships with people, you know, asking people, "How do you experience me?" especially my wife, you know, like,
yeah.
like what is it that I'm doing, or what is it that I'm not doing that would be helpful and that would contribute to your flourishing? And you realize, boy, I think about myself and what I want and what I need almost all the time, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think relationships are huge. I mean, this is Ephesians 4, right? Every yeah. joint and ligament supplies, and we grow to maturity in that way. So,
yeah. Yeah. We tend to forget the body of Christ. Like we do mm-hmm. like to be that individual where it's like, I just got to be a stronger finger. If I'm just a stronger, and it's like, yeah, but it takes a hand and it takes an arm and it takes right. a body. Yeah.
Yeah. Even the question, how are you? Like, you're talking about me, right? Like we don't think of ourselves as embedded in others. You know, someone could ask, how are you? And you could say, well, we're doing great. Like we're practicing vulnerability with each other, and we're really confessing sins and telling the truth. And, you know, it could mean my community, like, yeah. or my family, you know? So,
yeah, I actually just read a book, that talk some about that where, and he even referenced something else that you just said, where I wanted to ask is, he's like, we will forget what God thinks about us, like what he tells us, how he actually views us. Yeah. And, because we, the book's called The Expectation Gap by Steve Cuss, but, and he's like, we set our own expectations of ourself. And mm-hmm. he's like, but that doesn't mean that was the expectation that God placed on us, or we view ourselves as super low, and God's like, yeah, but I told you, I view you as an heir, and I view you as a child, and I view you as,
right.
and we forget it. How important do you see then the reminder of how God actually sees us and how he actually engages us?
Yeah. I think it's enormous. It's funny. I kind of think that pride and shame are two sides of the same coin. So we flip back and forth, and the coin is self-obsession. I'm awesome, thinking about myself, or I'm the worst thinking about myself. Right.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, like I've been reflecting a lot on, I think it's Psalm 46:10 about be still and know that I'm God. Yeah. Like the word be still is just relax. Like, can I just relax and be okay? Like, why do I need that? Why do I need to be or have that title or do that thing? Or, you know, can I just relax and say, I'm your child? And because I am joined to you, whatever happens, whether it's suffering or all that, I know that in the last day, I won't be ashamed. Mm-hmm. like that's, I mean, I'm just talking about Romans 5 now, like yeah. suffering produces character, or endurance and endurance character, and character hope. And why? Because God's working in me yeah. and he's making me more like himself. And so I know that in the end, I won't be put to shame, so I can boast in him, and I can boast even in that suffering. And so I think that the hardest, it's very simple, but very hard to just be able to rest and not try to prove yourself over and over and over again. The expectation gap, you have this expectations, this ego ideal, like yeah. this is who I am or who I ought to be. If only these other things would get out of my way and I just need to work for it. And then you're just like, no, I just need to sit in the fact that God loves me and he's made me his child and I can be still, you know, yeah. And I can work out of that stillness. I don't have to work for what I think I need about myself. So,
yeah, man. So I think I said this already, but I have not fully read this book. It will get done. I know people say that they'll do it, and you've said that. Yeah, right. I'm gonna read it just because I feel challenged by you saying that. I'm gonna read it.
I offered one friend of mine $20 to read it. I think I actually paid it.
Hey, I'll take it. You'll have to pay up. Yeah, I know, because you'll have to pay up. I will definitely finish it. Yeah. But you said there's specific chapters that we should get into. Have we covered each one of those chapters? I want to make sure that I've covered that content.
Yeah. So basically chapter one is kind of where I sort of set the table on the problem, and then, or maybe it's the intro, I don't know. But then chapter 8, 9 are about my model of emotions. So that's in conversation with neuroscience. There's some hard stuff in that chapter, but I think it's really practical.
Okay.
And then chapter 9 is about Matthew 6. And I think that's a helpful chapter for people to reframe how my model works in terms of biblical texts. And then the conclusion is basically what I'm trying to say, a sort of theological approach to care. So
I can tell you that this conversation has definitely made this very intriguing, especially because I guess I've been on this journey for a little bit going back to November. And so I'm very intrigued. I'm probably going to dive into it even later today because I'm very intrigued to find out more about your model. Is your model, how easily explainable is it on a podcast level like this?
Yeah, but I mean, basically it's what I call tiered psychology. So it's one, it's holistic. Like I don't think there's any mind body interaction, body soul interaction. Mm-hmm. So I think that the soul is just responsible for all of our living powers, including digestion or nervous system, right? So holism is one. Then the other part is tiered psychology, which is there's a difference between my reflective slow thought. This is Daniel Kahneman's. He has two systems. It's dual process theory. It's a number of different names, but there's a difference between my reflective thought and choices, and the ways that I perceive the world and the emotional reactions that happen as a result of my perception, and the interplay between those is important. Like how do I come to figure out, oh, what am I reading in the world? Like, how am I assessing the world? And then what do I think about it? And can I actually shape the way that I see differently next time? So basically the interaction between those two is really important. But then the third layer down is essentially the autonomic nervous system, especially the sympathetic nervous system and your parasympathetic nervous system. So like what is happening and the endocrine system. So what is happening in my body that actually makes my emotions perhaps stronger and what sort of over time changes can happen that work between all three systems. So
how important is self-awareness with some of this then?
Oh, it's huge.
Do you include anything?
Because here's the problem. Think about it this way. Anytime that you have a feeling, what's you've already judged something to be happening, and it pushes up in like, oh, I'm feeling uncomfortable. And in that moment, you're saying, why am I feeling uncomfortable? Mm-hmm. And you're gonna put an explanation to it. And you might say, well, because that guy's an idiot. And maybe not, actually. Yeah. Like that, the judgment that you're making may be, hey, I feel rejected. And so self-awareness, like the ability to actually give true explanations that correspond with reality to why I'm feeling what I'm doing, enables me then to take productive action. But if I give the wrong explanation as to why I'm feeling that way, then I can get into these destructive spirals where I never actually achieve self-knowledge, but then I end up doing all sorts of destructive things.
Yeah. I mean, so you have to be self-aware, but then you need help with people explaining, like, I don't know that that's exactly what was going on there.
Exactly.
And then you have to be willing to be teachable and learn, like, okay, maybe it was that. That is wild to even look at self-awareness through that scope.
Well, we're lying to ourselves all the time without knowing that.
All the time. That has been something in the last 6 months that has stood out to me, is that we love deceiving ourselves. We mm-hmm. And scripture is so clear about that we love to deceive ourselves. And we do it all the time.
Yeah, man. So you need people to help you out of that trap.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure if that's actually what's happening there, you know?
Yes. So how do you avoid maybe you've dealt with this, maybe you haven't, but do you have something where, how do you avoid surrounding yourself with yes people that will just tell you what you want to hear versus what you need to hear?
Don't move towards flatterers.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so flattery is a huge problem. It's way bigger than people realize.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Essentially slander is saying something behind someone's back that you wouldn't say to their face. Flattery is saying someone to someone's face that you'd never say behind their back.
That is a great definition.
And the fact of the matter is when I first heard that definition, I'm like, oh man, I flatter all the time. And that's a problem, because what am I doing? I'm using the person. I think the person can be some benefit to me. And so I'm saying this nice thing, and I'm actually just wanting to use them.
Yeah.
And so I've that's an internal check. But then I've also realized, well, people do that to me all the time. like if someone is overwhelmingly positive towards you and just is piling it on, I sometimes am like, you know, that can flip pretty quick. And yeah. So, like that when someone is willing to tell me the truth and say, hey, I think you messed that up. I'm like, okay, that's a possible friend right there.
Yeah.
Cause they can wound me for my good. That means they are courageous enough and care enough to wound me for my good. Right.
Yeah. I had a conversation with, one of my pastors at one point. They were like bringing me into the core, like executive pastor role or whatever. And I just said, I need you to understand that if you want a room full of yes men, you will have to fire me. And they were like, that's why you're in the room, Tim. It's yeah, like, okay. Yeah. So it's some of that though. Like, I'm not going to flatter you. I'm going to tell you. Now I can be wrong when I say, I've been wrong. Like when I say something, I'm like, hey, this, and they're like, yeah, but I don't think so because of this. And I'm like, oh yeah. Okay. I was wrong. But,
right.
But I'm going to say it.
As I get older, the sorts of people that I think are safe to be around change, you know, like I like people who can laugh at themselves, and I like people who just tell the truth and say, hey, here's how I see it. How do you see it? You know?
Yeah. That you can have a conversation where, you know, there's going to be some rough edges in this conversation, mm-hmm. but it's going to be okay. Like I know on the other side, we're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I agree with that. That is an interesting thought too, to just assess what type of people you should have around you mm-hmm. so that you're getting some of that. Yeah. I don't know that I've done that. It just kind of naturally happens.
Yeah. Well, I think that everybody loves praise.
Yeah.
So the risk with failure is that you're going to devolve into shame, anger, rage, bitterness, all that. The risk with success is that you'll be overpraised and you'll start to trust yourself more than you ought to. Like it just surrounded by people who want access to the power that you've achieved. And so then you're just hearing only things that you want to hear. Yeah.
No. So my son is autistic and he's grown so much. It's been incredible to see. And mm-hmm. he's a great little boy. Like he's just great.
Yeah.
But, I started noticing that he was getting hesitate to do something where he knew it was going to be hard.
Hmm.
And so I was like, we're playing soccer this year. And like, I was like, we're playing some organized sport because I need him to, I need him to get comfortable that it's going, like he's going to fail or they're going to lose a game or like, I need to be okay. And, mm-hmm. and he really, I think he did learn that through the season, but the first game he came up to me, it was at halftime. They were losing bad. He came and they were the red team. They were playing the pink team. And he came up to me and at halftime and he goes, can I go to the pink team? That tells you everything you need to know right there. Where I was just like, I get it, bud. But I would always tell him, like, I don't care if you win. I don't care if they take the ball away from you. I don't care if you don't score. I care mm-hmm. that you go out there and you just have fun playing a game and then let them go. So.
That's good.
Yeah, man. So let me just ask you some practical ministry stuff. So like, what are one or two books that you would recommend that if you're going to pursue full-time vocational ministry, like you probably need to read these one or two books.
Oh, wow. That wasn't on your list, Tim.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. Yeah. So I'm such an eclectic reader of books that it's hard for me to answer that.
Let's put it on anything. What are the, like, your go-to, if I came to you and said, you got to reread 3 to 5 books, what are those books you're immediately picking up to reread?
Yeah. So, I mean, I reread the Lord of the Rings trilogy every year. So there's that.
Okay.
But, books that have really impacted me. There's a lot of books that have changed the way that I see things. So Jonathan Haidt is a guy who has really changed the way that I see things. About a lot of different issues. Theologically speaking, I love basically everything that Kelly Kapich writes. He's been really formative. Obviously, my mentor, Kevin Van Hooser. So Drama of Doctrine changed the way that I saw theology and church ministry. His Hearers and Doers was really good.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of what else. What else would I reread? I reread a lot of fiction, honestly.
Yeah, so do I.
Because I it just helps get me in a good imaginative space. I've read C.S. Lewis over and over again. Lots of different things.
That dude messes me up and it frustrates me because I'll have a thought about something and he will, in a fictional book, not using God's word, completely shift how I think about it. I'm like, I hate what you just did to me.
Yeah. No, he's good at what he calls baptizing the imagination.
Yeah.
Like really helping people to see abstract things in concrete ways that really shift. So. Yeah, those are good questions. I wish I had more. I probably should get on my Goodreads and check all my 5-star books right now to see.
That's all right. That's okay.
That's a start.
You gave people plenty to start with there. Yeah. What would you say is one quality that you need to have if you're going to serve on a church staff?
Yeah. I wrote down 4. Is that okay?
Yeah. Go for it.
I'll go quick. One, just a relationship with God, like a sustaining relationship with God.
That can feel like a duh. That's a real thing.
No, yeah. I mean, the longer you're in it, they're like, oh yeah, that's why I need that, because you're going to go through things. And the question is, what makes you okay?
Yeah.
You know, like you can go to addiction and dysfunction and all that stuff, like a lot of pastors do, or you can get angry, or you can try and control people. There's lots of different ways people do this, but the question is, can I be still before God, or am I striving for me? The second thing is, I would say a commitment to the call rather than to personal achievement status. There's a great quote from Matt Campbell that I really like. He's the Iowa State head coach.
Yep.
And he says that there are guys that are trying to be somebody and guys that are trying to do something. And he wants the guys who are trying to do something. And so, like, if you're trying to do something, you're just trying to do the will of God, and it doesn't matter what your title is or what part of it you pick up at that moment. You just want, you want to see the gospel spread. You want to see disciples made and deepened and strengthened. Just people who hold on to roles too much. And I'm saying this as a guy who has held on to roles too much. So, third, active humility. And I think we just talked about this with self-awareness, like, ask people, how are you experiencing me? So, and then fourth, I would say moving toward conflict. So assume the best of someone, say what seems to be true, ask for input and feedback. Yeah. So, not leaving stuff out there. I've found so many times where, I'm just like super frustrated with a relationship in a simple conversation where I say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. Is that right? And it's amazing what happens after that.
Oh no, not at all. Oh, okay. And you're all in it for nothing. Yep.
Yeah. I got you. So those are the 4 things that I wrote down.
Those are good. Active humility. One thing that I've done, if you're on church staff and you supervise people, this is intimidating to do at times. The anxiousness will go up. But ask the staff that you supervise, like, hey, what's the one thing I need to work on next year? That'll tell you a lot. I've had to do that in the past. I'm like, hey, what's the one thing I need to adjust in my life that would make this a healthier work environment? And they'll tell you. It can be intimidating. But if you create the right kind of culture, they'll tell you. They won't tell you, like, oh, it's this, you gigantic jerk. It'll just be like, hey, I appreciate you asking me. I think it's probably this. I think it'll actually probably help your home life too.
Are you willing to set down your ego? The false image of yourself that you've built up inside you, you know?
You've created an idol. It's you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And what is one word of encouragement that you could give to those that are in a discouraging season? Maybe they're thinking about jumping out of ministry, just giving up the call, whatever. I know you've been there. I've been there. Mm-hmm. And so what do you have to say to some others that may be there right now?
Yeah. I think that I've been in situations where I'm sort of overwhelmed by the difficulties. I mean, you don't get into ministry for the money. Especially when you start your career at like 36, you know, so that's fun. But I think that the first thing I'd say, I'm going to say 2, I just don't stick to your rules. The first is that remember why you got onto this path. I've done this sort of thing where I'm like, okay, I know why I set out to do this. And then I'm also thinking forward and I'm saying, when I'm 65, what am I going to look back on this path and think of it? Like, will I have thought that I invested in the talents that God gave me wisely, you know, for this life? And honestly, that, you know, there maybe getting out of ministry is the right thing, or maybe it is, you know, for this season or something like that. So I'm not saying don't. I'm just saying when I do that, I say, yeah, no, that this is where I want to invest myself. Doesn't matter how hard it is. But the other thing is, I have really made a practice of distinguishing between problems and tensions. So problems are things you have to solve. And so you either have to solve them, you have to ask for help to solve them. Tensions are things that you can make peace with and learn to manage them effectively. And I think a lot of people upgrade tensions to problems, and then they just get super angsty about it. and they're like, no, actually, you probably could just open your hands to that and say, what are the small things I can do to make this tension better? And there's a lot of room to sort of manage the tensions, and a lot of resources too. So,
yeah, I think you can often, usually when we elevate it to a problem, it's because we think we need to solve something that is actually somebody else's to take care of or solve. Like, we can't actually control the situation. It lays with someone else, and we're trying to do something with it. It's just a tension that we have to deal with because we can't change it. So,
yeah.
I had another question off of that too. And I don't want to lose it. What was the first thing you said right there?
Oh, about remembering how you got into this, reflecting back on your life. Yeah.
I lost the question. It was right there. It's going to be so good. It's going to be like, man, that was the best question this whole thing. I can't think of it. I don't know. I can't think of it. But anyway, I do appreciate you being on, man. Anything you want to leave us with?
No, I think I've said everything that I came to say.
Pretty much, man. This is really good. I do appreciate it, because I know it's going to take a little bit more brain power for people to work through some of this, but this is stuff we need to work through. Like, this is about healthier spiritual Christian lives in sanctification, and we need to lean into some of this. I appreciate you putting in all the work and effort and waiting to start your career until 36 to do it all.
I'm glad that you appreciate it. My wife doesn't always. So.
See, I know your wife, and so you want me to tell you the one funny story I have from college with Molly. So yes. Molly would. So we were trying to save money. Every college student's trying to find ways to save money. So one way that we save money is a bunch of the college girls, they would cut our hair. So Molly was one of these that would. She was willing to just cut a lot of guys' hair just to let us save a few dollars. And she cut.
And she didn't charge anything.
She didn't. She was awesome. Right. Yeah, she was awesome.
I don't understand that. I did it just to be close to her, but go ahead.
Super blessing. It was a massive blessing that they were willing to do.
Yeah.
And she cut my ear one time right here.
I forgot about that.
So I'm sitting there bleeding. And she's like, damn, she felt so horrible. Just finish, Molly. It'll be fine. It's just my ear. It'll be okay. And like, it's fine. Like, that's why I wear these headphones, so nobody can see my deformed. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. So I'm super, I say this every time about people that I knew decades ago that I just see faithfully keep going. I'm so appreciative that you and Molly are still trucking. So. Thank you for being faithful.
Likewise.
Yeah. Thank you for being faithful. It's super encouraging to see it. I know we don't always get to talk, but from afar, it is extremely encouraging to me to just see other people being faithful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Tim. And I, likewise, it was fun to hear kind of what God's doing in your life right now. And, you know, coming up on 20 years of faithfulness in marriage also.
I know. So. It's been awesome, man.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Appreciate having you, and we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks so much, Tim.
Hopefully you could tell I wasn't joking when there's some depth to it. Honestly, I was a little bit intimidated in this conversation, just trying to get into the depth of everything that he's covered. But I think you could hear that there's a lot of practicality with it. Like, I'm in the midst of reading it, and I am excited about getting through this book because I think there's some very practical things if we can understand some of what's actually going on with us. So don't forget, if you want to check out the book, it's The Logic of the Body by Matt Lapine. And I will connect all those links and everything in the various platforms. So just you can check it out. You could probably just click it and get to the various links. Probably most likely on Amazon is where I'm going to send you, but you could get wherever you need to go with that. But I am so thankful that he was willing to come on. I hope you learned something. I hope it triggered some thoughts that maybe you'll take and carry and even go further with in your own life and apply some of these things to your own life, because we all need to be healthier. We want to be healthier in Jesus, and we need to be healthier in Jesus. And I hope this helps you take some steps towards that. Thank you so much for checking us out. Looking forward to our next episode, and I'll see you then.